Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London, with me, Robert Bound. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we'll be discussing the recent earthquakes in Iran, why it took so long for aid to arrive for those who needed it, and the lack of state media attention it's received. And despite the German economy growing by a barely worth celebrating 0.3%, it's still the fastest growing economy in Europe. We'll ask how long it can last.
Germany looks to possibly even overtake China again as having the biggest surplus in the world from exports.
We'll also be getting a roundup from the world's first culture summit to discuss the role of culture as international dialogue, and we'll shift our gaze to China, where we'll discover the appeal of 3D cinemas. Plus, we're joined by artist George Butler, who's just returned from a trip to Syria, where he's been capturing the conflict with a paintbrush.
People come up to you and see what you're doing, and it amuses them, or is a break from whatever they were thinking about before. So there's an element of trust there as well, because I think a camera can be quite an aggressive thing.
All that, plus our newest Midori House music session, and we flick through the business pages of our new issue of Monocle, all to come in the next hour here on Monocle 24. But first, let's get the news headlines with James Luckhurst.
Monocle 24 News. A leading Lebanese politician is urging foreign states to do more to help Syrian rebels defeat President Bashar al-Assad and spare the country an endless civil war and possible partition. Walid Jumblatt, head of Lebanon's most influential Druze family, said the battle for Syria hinged on foreign backing to the rebels, who he believes can easily expel Assad from Damascus. Nearly 158,000 people have now fled the violence in Syria, creating the need for increasing assistance and the registration of Syrian refugees in neighbouring countries, according to a spokesperson for the United Nations Refugee Agency. Adrian Edwards said there were now fewer people crossing to Jordan.
In Jordan, over the past 2 days, there has been a marked drop in the number of Syrians crossing into the country. We had only 283 crossing on Saturday night compared to what had been a steady average of about 400 people arriving every night since July. Refugees have reported being fired upon by artillery and small arms fire while travelling to the border.
Rescue workers in Iran have recovered more bodies 3 days after two powerful earthquakes struck the northwest of the country, killing more than 300 people. However, officials have played down reports that casualty numbers may still rise sharply. The quakes, with magnitudes of 6.4 and 6.3, struck East Azerbaijan province on Saturday afternoon, flattening villages and injuring thousands of people around the towns of Ahar, Varghazagan and Hariz, near the provincial capital Tabriz. There'll be more on this in Midori House immediately after this bulletin. The international ecological group Greenpeace has vowed to continue to pressure governments and private companies to keep them from drilling into the oil and gas-rich waters of the Arctic. The Greenpeace vessel Arctic Sunrise made an unsuccessful attempt to gain access to a Russian energy oil platform in the Pechora Sea. While not revealing details of future action plans, Greenpeace International Executive Director Kumi Naidu promised the organisation would continue to try to access drilling platforms in the Arctic.
Given the urgency, we do not make any apologies for the need for peaceful, non-violent, direct action that actually gets our political leaders and our business leaders to recognize that time is fast running out and that we have to act with greater urgency and with a greater level of ambition if we are to avert catastrophic climate change.
The Eurozone's economy shrank in the second quarter of the year despite continued German growth, which economists said could soon be snuffed out. Data shows the 17-nation currency bloc to have contracted by 0.2% on the quarter. Germany managed growth of 0.3%, marginally beating forecasts, but its forward-looking ZEW sentiment index slid for a fourth month running, undercutting even the lowest estimate in a Reuters poll. And Australia's Parliament has been debating reopening refugee detention centres on the Pacific Island nations of Nauru and Papua New Guinea to deter asylum seekers trying to reach Australia. Many lives have been lost when overcrowded boats carrying asylum seekers have sunk. In the past few days, there have been reports of another boat going missing with 67 people on board. Home Affairs Minister Jason Clarke.
Customs are still investigating this, but they hold grave fears for the safety of the people on the boat. We've been given a list by people in Australia of some of the people on the boat. We've checked that against immigration records here in Australia and unfortunately have not found any evidence that those people have arrived in Australia.
And those are the top stories here at Monocle 24.
Thank you, James. It's 5 minutes past 6 p.m. here in London, and you're tuned in to Midori House live on Monocle 24. You're listening to Midori House, live from Studio One here in London. Two earthquakes struck the northwestern province of East Azerbaijan 2 days ago, destroying dozens of villages, killing 306 people and leaving thousands homeless and injured, according to official reports. The US Geological Survey said the quakes hit within 11 minutes of each other in the late afternoon. The first had a magnitude of 6.4 with an epicentre 12 miles west-southwest of Ahar. It was followed by a second quake 19 miles west-southwest of the area. Iran is now ready to accept foreign aid, but the speed in which it has done this has received criticism, as has the lack of state media coverage of the earthquakes. One of the first reporters on the scene was AFP journalist Mohammed Davari, who joins me on the line from Tehran. Mohammed, thanks for joining us.
Nice to be on the phone.
Now, Agence France-Presse, for whom you work, covered this story, presumably as soon as they possibly can. You were one of the first peoples on the scene. Can you briefly tell us what you witnessed?
Well, as soon as the earthquake struck and the reports came out, as soon as we understood the magnitude of the crisis, a team of AFP journalists just drove up to the area, and by the time we got there, it was about 12 hours after the first quake. Help was on the scene. Rescue workers were going through the rubble, but it was not enough. People were expecting more. The villagers, these areas are mountainous, and most of the people living there are farmers. The villagers were just going through the rubble with the rescue workers looking for the bodies of the dead. The first village that I arrived was Bajibaj, which was about 50 kilometers north of Tabriz, Iran's third biggest city. And this village of 400 people population it used to have, 22 people had already been dug out of the debris dead. And women were just grieving, men were digging graves. And a few hours after I arrived, more help arrived, bringing food, water, tents. And as I could see, the whole area was devastated. Officials now tell us that more than 120 villages were just raised off the map by the earthquake.
Yeah. And this is a sort of picture that unfortunately becomes almost stock footage in a lot of news channels, the rolling news channels in the West and across the world. Why on earth didn't it make sort of the top headlines in its own country, in Iran?
That's the question that everyone's asking right now, actually. The state television has received a lot of criticism over this. The first night, basically a few hours after the earthquake on Saturday, the first night they just went on with their regular programming of covering the Olympics, and even they aired the comedy show, which has angered the people, basically. But the next day, Speaker of the Parliament and a lot of lawmakers from the area just openly criticized the state television. And they picked up their game, and for the past couple of days, they've been basically reporting anything that they can get their hands on from the area.
And we're also used to news agencies having sort of enough helicopters and enough sort of capability to deploy almost as soon as an emergency service. I guess this might not be the case in Iran, although I'm not sure. But is there something about this particular area that isn't popular with the authorities? Is there a political reason why the media, the official media, wouldn't cover it properly, Mohammed?
I'm not really sure about this. There are a lot of questions about the area, obviously, but a lot of ranking officials in this government actually are from the area, like the first vice president who traveled to the region today and spent a full day actually yesterday and a half of today in the area, just talking to people and offering help and promises to rebuild their lives, basically. The mountainous area suffer from like very harsh winter condition, and the government has about 2 months before the cold weather moves to the area, and they're basically facing an uphill battle.
And we're used to We're used to, in the West, possibly thinking of Press TV, which is Iran's rolling news network, to be a fairly unhealthy organ in terms of its sort of transparency with which it displays world news and the news coming out of Iran. Is there an element of that? I mean, are people discussing in the newspapers and, I mean, presumably online they are, about why or not the official Iranian media gave this such short shrift to begin with?
Right. Since the state has a monopoly on the television in the country, there's always talks about why the state television covers this or that or doesn't do this or that. And specifically with a sensitive issue like this, the criticism has been just running high, actually. And I'm not really sure about Press TV. People inside Iran don't really know Press TV and don't watch it. Mm-hmm. But with the state television, people were expecting more. That I can tell you for sure. And online, I've seen actually caricatures mocking the state television openly, which is quite new for what it is. Yeah.
Well, for the time being, we'll be relying on networks like yours. Mohammed Davari, thank you. You're a journalist for the AFP in Tehran. And you are listening to Midori House.
Modern Thailand is on the move. Take transport. We're building urban mass transit systems and a $15.4 billion high-speed rail link that will crisscross the country faster than ever before. We've even developed a solar-powered prototype of our famous tuk-tuks for a greener urban journey. And if you think that sounds good, wait until you hear our homegrown teapot. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
The September issue of Monocle is a global survey of flashpoints and fighting forces. In this inaugural defence-themed issue, our editors put on their flak jackets and pop on their helmets as they investigate everything from how to create a modern fighting force to how to design state-of-the-art camouflage. And we have lots more to offer too.
In the affairs section, we climb on board the USS George Washington to see why aircraft carriers still rule the waves. We head to Norway to visit the world's best officer training school. And I nip over to Brussels to interview Anders Fogh Rasmussen, Secretary General of NATO.
In the business section this month, we go inside the studios of America's leading camouflage designers. We take a look at the big businesses that have surprising defence interests. And we report on the major deals taking place at Farnborough this year. We also have our first Entrepreneur's Guide, a comprehensive look at how to set up shop. The battle-ready September issue of Monocle is on newsstands now and also available via subscription at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
And you're tuned into Midori House. On the subject of the new issue, we'll be speaking to our business editor, Jonathan Openshaw, after this, where amid a global economic crisis, wars and revolutions, culture ministers from around the world have spent the past 2 days in Edinburgh gathered for the first ever Culture Summit to discuss the role of culture as international dialogue. The summit is in place to discover why culture is important, to explore its contribution to social and economic development, and to compare international approaches to promoting and supporting culture. To give us a roundup of the summit, we're joined on the line by Paul Doherty, who's the head of British Council's 2012 activity. Paul, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So this is, you're right at the end, I guess. It's for the 13th and 14th, so you're coming to the end. It's going down the pub time after the Culture Summit. What were the key points that were raised? Was there a lot of agreement?
Yeah, there was a lot of consensus around the issues that were discussed. I think everybody agreed with the sort of central contention that culture is going higher up the political agenda. Notions of soft power are becoming mainstream. And so the idea of having a summit where culture ministers could discuss the issues was very much welcomed by all of those who were here, and indeed some of those who weren't here who told us that they thought this was a good idea. But beyond that, of course, as you would expect, there was a great deal of variety of response to the three main themes that we had for the conference. And what struck me was that there was a useful reminder of just how diverse we all are and the diverse approaches that there are to using culture, deploying culture as part of a nation's armory to present itself on a world stage.
And as the head of British Council 2012 activity, Paul, you must have a few sort of cultural sitting ducks before you. They must have come straight up from the closing ceremony, perhaps.
Yep, I think there were some who came up from the closing ceremony. This was always part of the plan, really, mm-hmm. that if people were in London, you know, why not bring them up to Edinburgh and have this summit against the backdrop of the world's largest cultural festival here in Edinburgh, the Edinburgh International Festival, not to mention the International Book Festival and the Festival Fringe. We thought that the culture ministers perhaps could, maybe we could all usefully be reminded that the raw material for what we're concerned with cultural policy, is the art itself and artists, and no better time to do that than now here in Edinburgh.
And it seemed, I mean, not wanting to dwell on the opening and closing ceremonies of the Olympics, but there was a lot of obviously brilliant British stuff that's heavily exported and very exportable that was on display, notably, you know, the music industry and the fashion industry was sort of had its cap doffed to as well. Is this the sort of thing that you're talking about giving these things a bigger sort of time under the spotlight than manufacturing and all the things that we used to pretend we did so well?
Yes, I mean, I think that was definitely part of the discussion. There was a lot of consensus in the chamber, the debating chamber of the Scottish Parliament, where we had the summit, that the UK had put on a very good show for the Olympics, particularly the opening ceremony and the closing ceremony were mentioned several times. It is interesting, though, to reflect that there are at least two levels to this. There is the level at which a cultural market operates in a normal way. So much of the cultural exports from the UK, for example, don't need any intervention from an organisation like us, whereas there is a whole raft of other things which can usefully benefit from intervention on our part and modest funding as well. In order to give a balanced picture of the UK, a picture of the whole of the UK, that's all of its constituent parts, but also all of the art forms, including the up-and-coming, the young artists and the cutting edge.
And, I mean, Britain's sort of punches above its weight or its sort of per capita worth, presumably, in terms of culture. Did you get the sense that some delegates were coming along to kind of scribble down quite a lot of ideas without maybe giving so many in return, Paul?
Yeah, I mean, sure. I mean, I think what I would say is that I think we too were scribbling down ideas. I think one of the great things about these kind of meetings is that it really is the case that you can learn a huge amount from others. We had some representatives from very poor countries, for example, who are wrestling with the issue of how do you get any funding at all for the arts and promotion of the arts, you know, when you're having to prioritize things like basic drinking water and electricity, those kinds of issues. But what's interesting is that some of the approaches that are adopted, some of the ideas that are coming from these kind of places are relevant to us in from the Western world, from the richer world, and we are able to, you know, take those ideas as well as give. It's definitely a two-way street.
And just finally, in terms of the soft power implications that you mentioned in your first answer, is this sort of good for the, as you say, the smaller, maybe poorer nations, that they can brand their country as something different from sort of the struggle that perhaps is the everyday for some of them, that they can present a picture that is where they perhaps would like to be, or a little bit more of a sunnier picture than the sort of stereotype that some of us perhaps in the West have of them?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely the case. And I think that certainly among the culture ministers here, they recognized very well, I think, that modest investments, because we're not talking about huge investments, we're not talking about defense or health or education, we're talking about the arts here, and modest levels of investment actually can make quite a big difference in putting a nation, you know, on the world stage. There are some very interesting examples, actually, countries that you wouldn't describe as poor, but who have nevertheless decided to invest in this area and have been very successful. South Korea is an example of that. Has invested quite deliberately in its culture being exported across the world to change perceptions of their country, change perceptions and ideas of what South Korea is, and also at the same time to showcase the idea that South Korea is a good place to do business, a good place to visit. It's a place that has a rich and vibrant culture, and you know, it's a country to pay attention to.
All right. Well, I hope the summit went well, and I hope that the downtime post summit is just as fun. Paul Doherty, head of British Council 2012 activity. Thanks for joining us. You are listening to Midori House. We'll be back in a second. And you're listening to Midori House, live from Studio One here at Midori House. A growth rate of 0.3% is rarely something to celebrate, but the news this morning that Germany's economy continues to grow, no matter how small the increase, has been greeted with relief across the Eurozone. It's a rare piece of positive news. News figures show France's growth, if we can call it that, to be flat. Europe-wide, the economy shrank by 0.2%. A little earlier, Monocle's Steve Bloomfield dissected these figures with Quentin Peel, Berlin editor for the Financial Times.
What is it in particular that has helped keep Germany just about in growth?
Well, as ever, it's exports still doing not too badly at all. Exports, particularly outside the Eurozone, have held up quite well. And its exports exports slipped less than imports slipped. So we're not getting much out of German domestic demand. It's the famed export economy. Indeed, there's been some forecasts that suggest that Germany looks to possibly even overtake China again as having the biggest surplus in the world from exports. But that's down the line. At the moment, the economy is undoubtedly slowing.
And is our exports alone likely to be enough for Germany over the coming months and indeed next couple of years? Or are there other measures that they need to take to ensure that their economy grows again at a more substantial rate?
I think everybody would like to see faster growth from Germany. It's so much the critical locomotive, really, the push factor in the whole Eurozone. If the German economy grows, everybody gets a benefit. And so everybody would like to see maybe a bit more activity from the German government into stimulating growth. The problem on the German government side is they're absolutely adamant that they're not going to increase their budget deficit. They're actually cutting it back steadily so that they get into balance in the next couple of years. And so the two things are not working together. The one positive sign I think we've seen from Germany is that there have been some relatively healthy wage awards recently, and the employment market in Germany is still remarkably sound. I mean, unemployment went up a tiny bit in July on a seasonally adjusted basis, not enough to change the actual unemployment rate. It's really still a pretty positive performance from employment. So if that were reflected in at least steady domestic growth and consumption figures, that would help everybody.
In a sense, do these figures almost help Angela Merkel in that she's been trying to make an argument across Europe that Europe can't just rely on Germany and Germany's economy, that even Germany's economy has its limits, and the fact that we are at 0.3% rather than motoring on a little bit faster does almost suggest that she might be right?
Well, I think certainly she would argue that. I don't think it'll stop other people saying, we need more out of you, Germany. Come on, you've got to do more. You've benefited enormously by this euro over recent years, having a stable currency with your main trading partners in Europe, and you've done really well out of it. And secondly, Germany, of course, is still doing very well out of the sovereign borrowing crisis. Their interest rates are incredibly low. So Germany's saving money on that front too. So I don't think anybody is going to say, Frau Merkel, we do understand you, you don't need to do anything.
On a domestic political front, I mean, is there anyone really in Germany who's willing to make that argument to say, actually, you know what, we've benefited from the euro. If we have to pay a little bit more now, that's only right, because, you know, if this whole thing falls apart, we're going to be in a lot of trouble.
Yes, I think the opposition is starting to make that argument.
It's taken them a while, though, hasn't it?
It has, and it's curious how, if you like, people have been unwilling to recognize the net benefit to Germany of the euro. I think people are finally starting to do that. Now, the opposition has always said we need to do more. We need to do more for Greece, we need to be more generous, and we need to think much more actively about some form of mutualized debt obligations, of actually Germany providing its guarantee to other borrowers, if only just to stabilize the markets. And the opposition has come out on that line. Mind, they're still saying it can only be done, Germany can only give its guarantee to other people, if they're prepared to give up their budget sovereignty so that there's joint control over everybody's spending.
And just finally, let's briefly turn our attention to the rest of Europe. Flat in France, 0.2% drop across everywhere. Portugal in real trouble. Any bright spots at all?
Well, it is only the north, I fear. It's Germany, the Netherlands, Austria. France and Germany both did better than expected. So that is a bright spot. Greece's performance, obviously, minus 6.2%. Horrendous. I fear there is another one that's horrendous, and that's outside the Eurozone, and that's the UK. Minus 2.5% is a very uncomfortable figure to be on.
And that was Quentin Peel, Berlin editor of the Financial Times, talking to Steve Bloomfield. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. The news is coming up next, but before that, this is Waste by Foster the People. And that was Waste by Foster the People. The time here is 18:30 hours here in London. You're listening to Midori House.
Están escuchando Monocle 24.
Dobropa Jalabert, Monocle 24.
Essa é a Monocle 24.
Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
In the next half hour of the show, we'll be discussing the business pages from the newest issue of Monocle, and we'll be discussing why 3D cinema could change the way the Chinese view films forever, in capitals it says here. But first, here's James Luckhurst with the news headlines.
A leading Lebanese politician is urging foreign states to do more to help Syrian rebels defeat President Bashar al-Assad and spare the country an endless civil war and possible partition. Walid Jumblatt, head of Lebanon's most influential Druze family, said the battle for Syria hinged on foreign backing to the rebels, who he believes can easily expel Assad from Damascus. Rescue workers in Iran have recovered more bodies 3 days after two powerful earthquakes struck the northwest of the country, killing more than 300 people. However, officials have played down reports that casualty numbers may still rise sharply. The international ecological group Greenpeace has vowed to continue to pressure governments and private companies to keep them from drilling into the oil and gas-rich waters of the Arctic. The Greenpeace vessel Arctic Sunrise made an unsuccessful attempt on Monday to gain access to the Russian energy giant Gazprom's Prirazlomnaya oil platform in the Pechora Sea. The Eurozone's economy shrank in the second quarter of the year despite continued German growth, which economists said could soon be snuffed out. Data shows the 17-nation currency bloc to have contracted by 0.2% on the quarter. And an Egyptian court is to hear the first legal challenge to a decree issued by Islamist President Mohamed Morsi that removed curbs on his powers imposed by the army. The challenge was filed in Egypt's administrative court by Mohamed Salem, a lawyer who's already tried to have Morsi's children, two of whom hold Egyptian and US passports, stripped of their Egyptian nationality. Those are the top stories here at Monocle 24.
And you are listening to Midori House, live from Studio One in London. Now, the new issue of Monocle hit newsstands this Thursday, our first ever defence special. And joining me in the studio now to discuss the business pages is our business editor, Jonathan Openshaw. Hi, Jonathan.
Hello, Rob.
Let's do that thing called cracking the spine on this thing.
I know, I've got freshly minted
sound effect
in front of me.
I like everything about this issue. It's kind of thick, it's good, it's got lots of camouflage in
it's
it.
It's looking
right?
sharp, isn't it?
You could.
I like a themed issue, actually. Sometimes.
I like a themed
issue.
It's quite
nice.
Strong.
I wasn't, when I first heard it was the defence issue, I didn't couldn't necessarily imagine how we were going to fill whatever it is, 270 million pages with it. But but no, it's worked really well.
And one of my favourite things about it is the opener for the business section. What a great headline, How to Get Lost. And this is your friend of mine, Aisha Spears, our New York editor. She went, well, not far from Monocle's offices, I guess. She stayed in New York to do this story about camouflage makers.
No, lazy. Just completely lazy.
So talk to what's it, are these designers or makers or both?
Yes, so we kick things off in the business section looking at, the business of camouflage design, really. I mean, it's a story that could have possibly sat in B or D, but it is a very interesting business. The US Department of Defense invested something like $5 billion in developing this new, very kind of snazzy, high-tech digital camouflage. And earlier this year, they basically... it's called Universal Camouflage System. It was supposed to be applicable for all terrains. They managed to create a system which was applicable in absolutely no single terrain. So now they've gone back to realising that actually the best things are, you know, done physically by hand. So Aisha went, she got inside one of these studios, which does a brilliant job.
There's a lot of pictures of making, of guys, it's all very physical.
And it's the kind of camouflage that you and I would recognise as, instead of trying to find a universal kind of digital format, what they do is they kind of make bespoke camouflage to scale. So it's about what the, you know, it's about the use, it's about the wearer. It's a little company called Cry Precision, and they're based in the, appropriately enough, in the former naval yard in Brooklyn, which is now a bit of a hotbed of design and media companies.
Nice. I love to see those guys kind of going out for a drink after work, dressed entirely in camouflage, mixing with all the hipsters, kind of like Bushwick or something.
I know, this is my favourite photo that we've had for a while, I think, it's on the opener of that feature, which is this huge kind of muscle-bound he's former military, actually, but now works in their kind of stock department, I think.
He looks like he's kind of like only just missed the casting for The Expendables 2.
Yeah, you wouldn't mess with him. But no, lovely feature, that one. Aisha did a brilliant job. And we also put lots of little kind of tidbits in on the kind of top kit they manufacture. We have a review of this quite incredible lookbook on camouflage, which was by Hardy Bleshman, who's the founder of Maharishi. The fashion label. So that's still a kind of reference point. I think you've published that in 2004. It's still pretty much a reference point. So yeah, we've got lots of bits in that lead.
And let's go on. So there's, we don't want to kind of gloss over the inaugural entrepreneur's guide.
Oh, well done. Would not want to do that.
But maybe we'll keep it on the kind of defence theme and go to this the second story in the section, which you managed to commission some nice illustrations there.
Yes. So this is a. It was a bit of a roundup. We were trying to think of how defence and business it's a complicated one. There's a lot of companies, freelance security companies, there's a lot of defence companies which you might not necessarily want to give editorial space to. Mm. So we've our kind of approach to it was to look at the kind of big companies, the big household names that we'd really associate with something very different, not something military defence at all, and look at the fact that actually they have quite surprising defence interests. So
Mitsubishi, who make your TV, possibly, or maybe your car, makes submarines?
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, they make submarines. What's surprising? So FedEx have done very nicely out of their contract with Department of Defence. I think they've grown something like 40... up to $90 billion or something through that. Swarovski... Very surprisingly, the kind of glamorous...
The glam jeweller.
The bejeweller of fashion brands everywhere. they make high precision optics for kind of sights and binoculars. John Deere are in there, Panasonic are in there. We've got Jeep, we've got Boeing. I mean, yeah, so it's a big mix of some of the brands that you might expect and some of the less expected ones. So.
I kind of like Volvo Aero. I presume that's... you know, they're well known as a maker of kind of like warplanes, or maybe the engines for them anyway, aren't they?
Yeah.
I don't know what that is. That looks like it might be Sputnik 2, or it might be an engine.
We threw a couple of curveball challenges to our illustrator. The Rolls-Royce engine looks a bit fiddly as well. But no, I like these pieces when we do. We did a similar one when we looked at the companies behind the Olympics a couple of issues back, and, you know, do some nice kind of big illo pieces and lots of kind of facts that you can imagine popping up in a pub quiz, so...
Yeah. Cool. Well, as long as it's giving us, as long as Monocle's giving us the answer to the most international of pub quizzes, Jonathan, we're safe. And I want to go. You talked a bit about kind of the thorny issue of not giving editorial space to people that might not necessarily deserve it because they might be in some slightly murky water. Mm-hmm. Considering this is a defence issue, and also you commissioned Sophie Grove, our senior editor, to do this thing on private armies. How did that work?
Well, I knew that I could count on Sophie to do a nuanced job on this one. So yeah, I mean, obviously, lots of the companies, you know, Blackwater springs to mind, you might not want to report on, you know, their quite negative, report on their kind of back history. But yeah, I mean, it's an interesting one because private security is so big, such a big deal. I mean, in these increasingly kind of pressurised times, especially, governments are forced to outsource a lot. We need only mention G4S and the kind of debacle around that. So yeah, we wanted to just look inside the, you know, give a kind of balanced idea of what the role this industry plays. So Sophie kind of opens with a lead essay. She's spoken to lots of key players in the industry, and then we kind of looked at four examples of interesting companies who have have really pretty high standards and do some interesting work. So we've got Bancroft Global in there. We've got Sea Marshals, who operate a floating anti-piracy base in the Red Sea. We've got Fox Delta, and we've got IDG Security, who exclusively use former Gurkhas and actually also were the security for our very own Monocle Fair. So
if they can police Monocle Summer Fair, spelled with a Y, they can do anything. They are the, I mean, I can't use the word I wanted to, but you know what I mean. They're the dogs, aren't they? And also, it wouldn't be an inaugural defence special unless you yourself, Jonathan, made it to Farnborough for the air show.
Exactly. I know, I got the best gig, I think.
Did you get to go on a helicopter? Did you go upside down in anything?
I wore lots of kit. I didn't actually leave the ground. I didn't leave the field, but I got to wear a visor. They didn't include a photo.
Is that you? That's not you. I was going to say, it's a less handsome man than you, top
Someone
left.
Someone else in a visor, sadly. But I mean, that was, I have to say, a completely bizarre and fascinating experience for me. Never been to a big aerospace fair. Farnborough is at the aerospace industry in general, but it's, I think, around 50% defence at the moment now. So truly bizarre, kind of a few fields in Hampshire. Obviously a huge industry descending on Farnborough, but also has this very bizarrely kind of British feel to it.
Yeah.
You're ferried from the car park in former Routemaster buses. So you have this ridiculous image of kind of Omani businessmen queuing up outside a old broken down Routemaster. And then lots of the locals kind of set up trestle tables on the outside selling earplugs. But I mean, obviously you get inside and you're dealing with the huge, Thales, Boeing, the big boys of the industry. And it's where people go to kind of, release their latest products and also to announce the big contracts. Around 60 million in contracts was announced this season. That was up from 38 million in 2010. So even though we're looking at these kind of straitened times for lots of national defence companies, there's the other, still certainly in the West, but there's the other three quarters of the world which are still quite keen to defend their assets
or otherwise. And Farnborough presumably sounds like a day trip to me. It doesn't sound like it's a great place to go.
I didn't need 2 days.
You did?
No. Our photographer did, heroically.
Really?
Yeah, stayed for 2 days. He did a very thorough job of it.
Oh, Nick Ballen. Well. I've worked with him.
He's great. He's brilliant.
But cool.
I was in and out.
We shall leave it there, Jonathan Openshaw. Thank you very much for talking us through section B of Monocle's inaugural defence issue, out on Thursday. You're listening to Midori House. We'll be back to discuss China's desire for 3D cinema. Just next.
At one of the world's busiest seaports, Laem Chabang, it's easy to see why Thailand is such a dynamic trading hub. With our entrepreneurial, multi-skilled workforce, we're busy making sure vital goods get to market on time, every time. It's this hands-on approach that's made us the globe's fifth largest container shipping nation. But it's not only goods we're exporting. Our pop music is a big hit too. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
And you're listening to Midori House with me, Robert Bound. The director of 3D blockbusters Avatar and Titanic, James Cameron, is launching a joint venture in China to market his company's 3D technical wizardry to the country's fast-developing TV and film industries. Cameron hopes to take advantage of box office explosion in China, where the film industry is booming and the number of cinemas is on the rise, potentially offering one of the most lucrative markets in the world. Joining us to discuss it further is film critic Karen Krasanovich. Karen, hi, thanks for joining us on the show.
Oh, my pleasure.
It seems we're always sort of told that sort of China is an untapped kind of well of wealth in every sort of single degree, but often not in sort of culture and media ways. Is there really a sort of explosion of cinemas in China or of 3D screens in China?
Well, there is a growing middle class in China, and that's one of the things that filmmakers like Cameron and others are focusing on. Yes, there is an enormous explosion. For example, 7,000 of China's 11,000 screens are now 3D capable, and they're expecting to install several thousand more in the next couple years. So it's very interesting, and what's really interesting too is that a lot of these are in rural communities. So if they can keep the cost down, the people could actually have their first cinematic experience as 3D, which is pretty astonishing.
So this is like, I mean, this is like people kind of like, I suppose this is the people seeing IMAX for the first time if they'd only ever watched black and white or something, I suppose. This is a big sort of leap of faith for people to make.
Actually, let's say that you'd seen were the DVD at home or things on television or whatever. The first time you go into a theater, the first time you go into a cinema, it's IMAX 3D. I mean,
yeah,
it's an amazing experience for somebody for a first timer.
And does China itself have the expertise at the moment? I mean, are Chinese productions being shot in 3D? I mean, are they the sort of 3D add-ons that we sometimes see Western directors having to do to their films, or are they being shot wholly and purely in 3D to sort of answer the demand that the screens have?
Well, there are different kinds of approaches to the 3D procedure. Some of it's what they call live 3Ds, where things sort of poke out at you. And then there are others, for example, like Brave, which are less sort of pokey outy. And they're saying that the Chinese audience quite likes the live ones, where stuff comes and sticks out at you in the seat, as opposed to...
That's the pokey outy, right? That's
the... In the background.
That's the pokey outy.
That's the live 3D. That's the term
you want to patent, yeah. Isn't it, Karen?
It's pokey outy TM. Yes, it's mine already. But what James Cameron's so excited about is he's actually taking a lot of his own patented 3D cameras and equipment to Chinese filmmakers, and I like the way he puts it, with potential, so they can produce 3D films in China themselves. And I think that there's a whole untapped resource of artists and professionals there. Because you know, China's got a pretty good domestic film production industry. And what's interesting is that so far what's been popular with them, I think it's the painted, I know I'm going to get this wrong, the films that they're showing there are things that might not necessarily cross over to an audience outside China. So what were they looking for? Hollywood is looking for this enormous untapped audience, and Chinese filmmakers are looking, you know, the same thing. They're looking for an untapped audience outside China. So it's going to be a very interesting crossover.
And I mean, a lot of you said that obviously some of this stuff won't make it outside of China, or it was the sort of stuff that wouldn't make it out at the moment. We're probably drawn to Flying Daggers, House of Flying Daggers, Crouching Tiger, these sorts of movies, which are very action packed and epic and have lots of pokey outy bits. These would be brilliant 3D movies, I guess. I mean, is this? Do you think this would change the sort of way that you know, maybe the Hong Kong action movie might survive very well in 3D, but maybe the more sort of introspective things might not? Does it change? Do you think it would change the way that sort of Chinese cinema works, the language of Chinese cinema?
Well, it could be. I mean, if James Cameron's right, then 3D, and of course, you know, this is just his opinion. I mean, a lot of people would say no. He thinks that 3D is similar to the black and to the shift in Western cinema from black and white to color, which For example, he says it has taken 25 years to do, and he thinks that China will embrace 3D as normal within a decade. I'm not really quite sure that's going to be the case. Also, 3D films are not generally, and I've talked this over with producers and directors, a lot of filmmakers feel that 3D isn't suitable for every kind of story.
Mm-hmm.
So in a love story, you might not have as much opportunity to use 3D in a dynamic way. You know, here's the ring, you know, and it goes into the audience. It's not as much as you were suggesting that some of the action movies would really benefit from these. There seems to be an interesting experiment going on with people being comfortable wearing glasses in China, and some people are and some people aren't, because also that one of the great things about having an action-packed story is that you don't need as many words.
Uh-huh.
So that makes the problem of subtitles a lot less important.
All right, Cameron, we're going to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us on the line. Our red and green glasses will be pointed towards China. And you're listening to Midori House. Next up, we'll be catching up with an artist who's arrived back from Syria. But first, here's a song performed in the Midori House performance space only yesterday from his beautiful Midori House session. This is James Yorkston with Border Song.
Something o'clock, the bird clock called, and I shivered and I shuddered, half awake, and my back was turned, but half asleep, I envisioned a rook, angry and ash shoot from coming down the chimney, anxious to peck at the eyes and to poke at the feet of the slumbering Scotsman and his. The more fun we're having, do you not care, for I do not care, we cannot afford to care, as this is nothing, just a flirt, just a flicker, just a taster of what is not to come. This is nothing, just a flirt, just a flicker, just a taster of what is not to come. This is nothing, just a flirt, just a flicker, just a taster.
And that was James Yorkston with Border Song. You can hear more of that beautiful session and a chat with me and James next Monday on The Culture Show. And you're back with Midori House. Now, illustrator George Butler's first project was drawing soldiers in Afghanistan, and from there he went on to depict oil fields in Azerbaijan and the G20 riots in London. Last week, he was in Syria, in the northwestern town of Azaz, and was impressed, among other things, on how children were playing among the tanks and the rubble. He joined us in the studio earlier to talk about his experience in Syria. Now, you're fresh back from Syria. When did you get back?
I arrived back yesterday.
And it's sort of 24 hours of travelling.
I actually made the mistake of getting the bus across Turkey. So,
I love that. Travel tips from war artists. It's a new section.
It's 24 hours if you get the bus.
Right. And you've come in, you've brought some things with it, which I should imagine the pen and ink and the washes on them are just sort of dry, or they must have just got dry as you put them in your case.
Yeah, it's pretty hot. Actually, they dry, you know, almost immediately. But
I suppose that's one of the things.
Great,
you can work in oil on canvas and it would dry just as quickly almost.
You can't stand outside very long because it's so, you literally sort of 15, 20 minutes and then you're, well, for me, it's just too hot to carry on working. So you're slightly dictated to by sort of shadow or time of day or...
Yeah, well, presumably that's the interesting thing, that you're dictated to by presumably the heat of the place, and
yeah,
but also the circumstance. I mean, I know you were in Azaz, which is in the north of Syria on the border with Turkey. What's the situation right there now, and what's the situation like for an artist?
My understanding is this, that probably 2 weeks ago, Syrian army and the Free Syrian army battled for control of Azaz, and the Free Syrian army have come out on top, but at the cost of some of the streets and buildings, mm-hmm. and at the cost of most of the civilians leaving.
So the people here—I mean, the people here that you've sketched, that you've drawn, that are in your pictures—who are these? Are these the Free Syrian Army, or are these the people?
Some of them are Free
of
Syrian
Azaz.
Army. What was interesting about the time that I was there and the fighting finished, as I said, 2 weeks ago, was that people start to sort of drift back in and find whether their shops had been raided or shot through or their houses had been shelled. And so the drawings are really not a record of the fighting, because that would be sort of difficult to recreate, and not trying to be in competition with a photographer or a filmmaker. But they're sort of record of what happens once war was kind of rolled through your city and what the people do once they when they get back. So these are the sort of week, 10 days that followed the end of the fighting.
And as you say, it's a different, it's obviously a far different medium to being a TV reporter or a war photographer. Do you feel you have a different relationship with the people that you've taken some portraits in here, as well as some landscapes populated obviously by the civilians and some of the Free Syrian Army? What sort of do you think your relationship with them is different? It's different to poking a camera in their face.
Yeah.
Is it a more considered thing? Are they more able to sort of go about their business without intrusion?
It's a great question. The process, which is you've got to get there and sit down and find a spot and start drawing for an hour or an hour and a half, is a great introduction because people come up to you and see what you're doing and they're interested by it and it amuses them, or it's a break from whatever they were thinking about before. And so there's an element of trust there as well, because I think a camera can be quite an aggressive thing.
And I guess also there's that thing that certainly in that part of the world in recent years, a camera has probably been a bit of a portent of doom. You know, there's not many good news stories that have been told with the camera, whereas presumably a box of paints is an entirely different thing.
Yeah, I mean, it is still, I hope, a record of what's going on.
That's interesting. It's interesting that you stumbled there, because I want to know what verite is in these pictures, because I wonder whether, you know, if there's a mosque right there and it's just in line with a tank, whether they're all in the picture as you see it, but whether you sometimes have to align things slightly to make the picture make sense.
Well, what's great about having so many photographers and film crews there is that you are kind of safe in the knowledge that someone will have already taken a photograph and a bit of film. So for historical accuracy, you're slightly let off the hook.
Yeah.
And also it almost impossible to be as accurate as a camera, but so it is open to your interpretation. It's your opinion of what's going on and your experience of what's in front of you. So if there are things that you want to leave out that aren't important to the story, or things that perhaps are important to the story but are just slightly too far to the right, then you can move it in. But what I did find about drawing in Syria was that, because it is quite shocking, or shocking to me, to sort of arrive in this place, I found myself being as sort of accurate as I could in terms of numbers of windows, like facial expressions, which buildings went where and what they did and things. So, yeah, I mean, it'd be interesting to compare the next to sort of photographs in sort of...
And how do you travel? I mean, you said you made a mistake by getting the bus back, but...
The bus was a mistake, yeah.
Presumably you have to travel very light. I mean, do you take just the sort of three or four paints, the primary colours, and mix on the spot? How does it work?
It's like a tin of watercolours, so it's, and pen and ink, so it's... That's the kind of beauty of it. You can move around very easily. The paper is A2, so it's actually quite large to be working on location. And then just as much of that as you can carry. But, I mean, there's always someone who's been doing painting or using paper for something. So you can actually find a lot of stuff when you get there if you get short.
And have you had to sort of give people portraits, or have you had to give people paintings to... Out of just people, because people have been so curious, you felt like you owed them a picture or to get yourself
Some
out of a sticky situation.
Times, I mean, they quite often understand that it's your job or it's your sort of talent, because a lot of the things that they do are with their hands or sort of skill based. So they don't often ask for them, but they always sort of say thank you for coming and drawing and thank you for taking interest in our cause. Occasionally, I leave one behind, but only if I like it.
So tell us about how you got there, because you said that it's sort of actually surprisingly easy to get across the border.
Yeah, so I went to Gaziantep, which is a town in the south of Turkey, and I took a bus to Kilis. Then, a taxi to the border. They sort of stamp your passport. They've got their new Free Syrian Army flag, and so it's just getting organised. I mean, it's kind of an indicator of how sort of little time they've been there. There's no kind of uniform or anything like that, and not necessarily organisation, and the rules change daily. But if you're friendly and sort of interested, and I sort of explained what I wanted to do and why, and that was, I was then a sort of guest of theirs, and sort of wonderfully humbling to be sort of allowed to do it, because they've got much sort of bigger things to worry about. But
I suppose so. But there's something kind of wonderful about being immortalised in a painting, right?
It's
attractive.
They just enjoy the interest either way, of either themselves sort of sitting and posing for you, or the fact that someone else will know about the situation they're in.
And that was artist George Butler and I chatting earlier in the show. And that's all we have time for today. Thanks to our producer, Dawn Trump, our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager, Ben Jay. Up after the news, it's this week's edition of Section D, where we'll hear about the favourite things of Gonzalo Fonseca, the charismatic founder of Madrid leather goods brand Stevie Mono. And we'll take a tour around Berlin's store, Collor. In 3 hours' time, at 2200 hours in London, it's the Monocle Daily, and Midori House will be back at the same time for tomorrow. For the time being, thanks for tuning in.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
Добро пожаловать, Monocle 24.
Du lytter til Monocle 24.
Você está escutando Monocle 24.
Sie hören Monocle 24.
Acute Monocle 24.
Kuuntelet Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
A Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.